Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving, gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 365, and it's proudly brought to you by the always growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you'd like to support the show, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. My name is Jason Heaton, and I'm joined as ever by my friend and co-host, James Stacey. James, how are you doing? We just got done chatting a little bit about some Canadian...
Yeah, you went to like an indie film house.
Yeah.
And one of the trailers was for an exceptionally obscure Canadian comedy series that now has a movie called Nirvana the Band the Show, which is now Nirvana the Band the Show the movie. And I was trying to explain it to you, and I realized the more you try and explain Nirvana the Band the Show, the dumber it makes everybody sound. But yeah, that is a deep a relatively deep slice of post-millennium, you know, Canadian comedy.
Maybe we should quit while we're ahead here. We're going to start losing listeners here. Where people are gonna...
I'll put it in the show notes. If anybody wants to check out a really absurdist, fantastic, sort of deeply meta comedy series, which I was a big fan of, but it ended in 2018 and now they're doing a movie. I'll put it in the show notes. But yeah, we don't have
to. The trailer was very opaque. I needed some explanation.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like unless you watch the show, the trailer's almost valueless. Yeah. But maybe it would catch a few people. I'm not sure. And also, there might be legs for that style of comedy in like a post, I think you should leave context, like Tim Robinson's show, or now many shows that he's done with the Detroiters and the Chair Show and all that. But maybe there's more legs. I'll definitely be checking out the movie at some point. But I feel like I need to go back and rewatch the show.
I might give that a miss.
Yeah, fair enough. Hey man, it's like I said, it was very like, I think you had to be like kind of a very specific age.
Yeah.
Me and my brothers, you know, had a thing for this. So,
well, speaking of Toronto, this is an awkward segue, but speaking of Toronto, you have some news about Timepiece show season, including Toronto.
Yep. Yeah. So in past years, we've always been sort of putting this news up front as soon as the tickets are available. And I actually spoke with Jason Hutton last week, and we missed the kickoff of the ticket season for Vancouver and for Montreal, but those are both up. So much like with last year, I'm going to be in Vancouver myself. Jason has another adventure to go on and can't make it. So if you make it to Vancouver, I'll be there. We'll be hanging out. It'll be a fun show. It's a nice kind of relaxed weekend as far as I'm concerned. And we'll probably do some sort of additional programming. Last year, we had a great party with Marathon at Roldorf and Co. And if that can be repeated, it will. We're just kind of in the planning phases for that. So stay tuned if you're going to be in Vancouver. But that is the weekend of April 25th and 26th. So what I'll be, it gives me like probably like 7 or 8 days to get home from from Watches and Wonders before that kicks off. And then for those of you who either can't make it all the way to Vancouver, want to stay more to the eastern side of the country, or simply want way more watches, don't forget that there's now Montreal in its first year. That's the weekend of May 30th. It's a fantastic time to be in Montreal. Currently, I don't have any, Jason and I don't have any plans to be out there, but if it's something that I can make work and jump on a train and bring the family out, I'm really not going to turn down the chance to get to Montreal, but it should be a really good one. Like I said, great city to hang out in, great city to be spring, early summer in. Fantastic food, lots of other things to do if you're in the city and, you know, want to do more than just visit the watch show. Tickets for those are all live, to my understanding, and that's timepieceshow.com, but you'll also find a link in the show notes. And yeah, so we're continually happy to support the shows and their schedule, and I'm already very much looking forward to Vancouver. I was trading some texts with our buddy Ken at Arkin about that, and yeah, it should be a good couple of days out there. At the end of April,
and then Toronto, end of September again, thereabouts. Which
I don't know if the dates are locked in, but yeah, it'll be that one of the last two weekends in September. If the dates are up, they'll be on timepieceshow.com, and Jason and I'll be around for that. And you know, if we have the option, we'll be doing a live episode like we have been doing. And the marathon party and all that. It'll be not to make it too casual, but a very much we're in more of a rinse and repeat. Don't break what's working quite well as far as the Toronto show goes. That's a good one. If anything, I'll just work on coaxing Jason to come up here for a little bit longer so we can go up to the cottage and have sort of a more outdoors adventure before we get back down into Toronto and into show mode. There's some diving that would be fun to do at the cottage.
Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds like, you know, our episode last week with Guy Allen from Elliott Brown, they're planning on being in Toronto again. So that's, That's cool. Always fun to see them. That episode seemed to hit right with a lot of people. We got some good feedback on that. And yeah, it was great to have Guy on.
Yeah, I think the main feedback I got was we can do more, Guy. We would be happy to hear more about emerald trading and that era, and then more in depth with some of the other brands that he had worked with over that time. So hey, it's always nice, as you can tell from today's title, it is always nice to have people on that we're happy to have on multiple times. I got to tell you, I'm so excited for today's episode. We haven't recorded, or I have not recorded my chat with Cole. I'm going to do that face to face in Geneva in about 36 hours from when we're recording this. And I'm just super, super pumped. So we'll get to that chat in a little while. Cole Pennington 4, I believe he's the only one to cross the 4 threshold. And it's been, I think it's like 189, 190 wow, was the last. It was 189 was CP3. Jeez. So CP4 is a long time coming. I don't know. Who knows how long this is going to be?
Yeah.
But we will get to that tape, hopefully really, really good sounding tape in just a few minutes. I guess before that, Jason, besides your indie movie night with an inscrutable Canadian comedy trailer, what have you been up to?
Yeah, I mean, we've had some spring fever here. It's been sloppy and warm, record temperatures for mid-February, and I'm not complaining. Other than I mentioned to you that the dog walks are treacherous in the morning because it freezes overnight, and then very wet in the afternoon. And there's a lot of cleanup involved with Ruby. You know, she's kind of built low to the ground, and so tends to get pretty mucky when we go wading through deep puddles and jumping after squirrels and climbing sloppy snowbanks and that sort of thing. But other than that, I couldn't resist getting my bike out on Friday. I've been running somewhat regularly over the winter, but I was like, I want a little different form of exercise. And so I pulled my bike out, and boy, that was a mistake. It was so wet, and there was just still a lot of patches in the shade where it was kind of icy. And I mean, it was kind of fun to kind of do something different and just sneak a ride in mid-February, but it was a bit mucky. And then similarly, I was able to pull out the roofless roofless old Land Rover, the Series 3, pulled that out of the garage, fired right up, a few pumps of the gas and popped the choke, and it always starts right up. I love that thing. It just goes, I never even disconnect the battery. I used to be so meticulous about winter storage when I had my Alfa Romeo, and
for sure.
With the Land Rover, it's just, I think there was kind of built to just be ridden hard, put away wet, as they say. And that's what I did. So it was great. I put Ruby in the back and took it for a spin a couple of times this weekend, and just, it felt good. I mean, it was a little chilly, driving around with no door tops on and just the windscreen up. But yeah, it was great. Good to blow the carbon out, so to speak.
Oh, that's awesome, man. Yeah. My Jeep has been living at my parents' driveway.
Oh yeah,
since September.
I hope it's getting a little exercise.
And my dad was starting it and letting it run, and then just in the last, I mean, I say the last recent, it was probably around Christmas, he wrote me and he's like, yeah, it's dead. So I guess the battery didn't enjoy that or something. I'm not sure. I mean, there's been some sort of a parasitic electronic problem with all the dumb stuff I've added to the Jeep over the years, and I think a bad ground, the G101. I've redone it a couple times. Anyways, this isn't that interesting. I will have to go out, condition that battery, and then I think it will start up just fine. We just haven't decided, if it's something that we're going to part with or, keep kind of in the wing somewhere for use at a later date or more often in the summer or something like that. We only have the one parking spot. We really don't even drive that much until you get to cottage season. And even then we're just together. So like the two vehicles is kind of overkill. And sadly, as much as I just very much miss the Jeep and, driving a manual and all that kind of stuff, it just doesn't fit as well into our lives these days. You end up treating it like a sports car.
Yeah. I feel like we're going down weird tangent rabbit holes this morning, this reminds me, there was I've been seeing these ads lately for and maybe you've seen these, a snowplow attachment that fits onto a 2-inch trailer hitch on the back of a vehicle.
Yeah.
So that you can
I got that Instagram.
You just I just thought that was such a brilliant simple solution. I mean, of course you're backing up all the time, but like for somebody that parks in a garage or has the space to kind of maneuver, I thought that was kind of clever. I thought that was really kind of a neat solution for like plowing a wide driveway or, you know, a small parking area or something like that, to just put it into the trailer hitch and just back up and push the snow. It's a great idea.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea at all. Especially if you think you drive into your garage.
Yeah.
Like you nose into the garage and the next day your driveway is now full if you have a garage.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's definitely a couple days this year where I kind of was like, wow, I'm starting to understand people who have the snowblowers.
Yeah.
I can't do it personally.
Yeah.
I am starting to understand it. We got a bunch of snow this year.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. But I did get served that Instagram ad of the.
Yeah. We aren't seeking sponsors here. This wasn't a paid plug for this gadget. I just thought it was fun. Yeah.
For sure.
What else? Anything else new?
I'm curious, did you get through Night Manager season 2?
I started it. I think I watched an episode and a half, maybe two episodes, and it didn't grab me like season 1 did.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything wrong with it. I think just the first one was just so good, like just the plot and the settings.
Yeah.
But I'll probably keep working through it. You're done with it now?
Yeah, we finished it. I would say like for me probably the first couple episodes were the best.
Hmm.
And then it had a fairly sharp decline. I would say that I like largely really didn't enjoy the show by the end of the second. It's like, I don't know. There's a lot of like themes that felt kind of like I didn't need them. If that's the right way to put it, like just a lot of like daddy issues and these like this reoccurring, but yeah, I don't know. I was curious as to what you thought of it, but I guess it doesn't speak super highly if it didn't grab you after the first ones were that first season was just something else.
It really was. Yeah.
And to be fair, this might be more of a me problem than a problem with the show, because I believe it's been given a third season.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
Is my understanding. But yeah, I enjoyed the first couple episodes. I love the idea of, you know, I don't want to give anything away because I would still want people to enjoy it if they can. I loved the setting.
Mm-hmm.
Totally different than season 1. Very adventurous sort of setting. Lots of great little off-roaders and dirt roads and that sort of thing. Yeah, there's parts of it I really liked, and there are parts that felt like they had an exceptionally constrained budget. And then there was some theme work that I really thought they could have just not included. And it would have strengthened the sort of overall like character. The ending was fun as well. I will give them credit for the ending of season 2. Maybe we can talk more about it if you get back to it. But that's about all. I had very little to do this weekend, which is very rare for me. Watch some 30 Rock reruns from, you know, a very long time ago. Really sat on the couch and just questioned how they ever put some of those jokes on television. But, you know, God bless. Yeah, it was good. So you sent me a photo of Ruby in the back of the series 3. Everybody looked happy and sunny, and you could barely tell it was, mid-February.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Winter's going to make a comeback apparently this week, but, you know, it's okay. It's nice to get a reprieve for a couple of days.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, how about some wrist check, and then we jump right into this chat with Cole.
Yeah, it looks like you're well-suited for your visit to where you're going. I'll go first, though, before you move into a good segue. I pulled out a watch I haven't worn a lot lately. That I used to wear more often. It's the Vertex Bronze 75. So this was released for the 75th anniversary of D-Day several years ago. It's the 40mm bronze cased version of Vertex's M100, kind of their classic Dirty Dozen homage. I don't wear it a ton, but I used to wear it. It used to be kind of a go-to camping watch because of the great loom. Alex from Haviston Straps, I hadn't heard from him in a long time. He wrote to me a week or so, probably 2 weeks ago, and said he had a new strap coming out. Was I interested in checking it out? So he sent me, he's got this canvas two-piece frogskin camo strap that, at first glance, I was like, okay, you know, it's not kind of really my taste, but on this watch, it looks really good. It has that kind of same kind of warmth, kind of retro look to it with a bit of a military-inspired kind of theme going on here. So that's what I'm wearing today. It's a great piece. And it's fun to have a hand wound watch on. You know, most of mine are either quartz or automatic.
Yeah, for sure.
It's just nice to have that bit of a ritual. So I've been wearing that for a couple of days.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. That's a goodie. I mean, obviously I'm a huge M100 fan. It would be on the continued short list. I got to see Frank's at the Thanksgiving hangout.
Oh, nice.
In New Hope, and just very, very cool. Yeah. So that's a winner for sure. Great size on that watch, fantastic dial, all that kind of stuff.
All right.
And for mine this week, you know, we're 6-7 hours from taking off for a flight to Geneva for a little Tudor press event with a few other outlets. And obviously I've got my Tudor Pelagos 39 back on the bracelet as my son will not be joining me for this week's frivolities. And I can have the bracelet on. And yeah, I figure that's the right one. We'll probably have more kind of helpful details and background in the chat with Cole, but I would like to hear some of it from his background, as it's not your usual press trip. I would say probably the only time I've gone on one like this. And it's my understanding Tudor won't be doing it again.
Wow.
So we'll fill some of that in the chat. But yeah, what else was I going to wear?
Yeah,
I mean, it remains my favorite sort of higher end, nice, luxurious tool watch on the market. I think the sizing's incredible. I like the bracelet. I like the micro adjust. It's the timekeeping's fantastic. There was a great thread recently on the Slack all about people's kind of pros and cons for the P39 specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, you know, where the FXD, there's multiple versions, colorways, GMT complications, that sort of thing. And then with the 500 meter Pelagos, we have a few different versions, of course. And then you FXD even goes into carbon and that sort of thing. The 39 remains on its own. And as we get closer to the big show in April, I think there's more and more conversations about, hey, does this mean we're going to get the blue one? Will the blue one have a sunburst dial? And what will that look like? You know, blue, the black on the black dial on the P39 quite often just kind of looks black.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just a very direct sort of sunlight that unveils or kind of reveals the sunburst pattern. But I don't know that you'd get the same effect from blue. So who knows, right?
Yeah, and then Tudor's been playing around with the Dune colorway for the Ranger, and the Ranger's been a bit of a hit lately. Who knows? I mean, a Pelagos with a light color dial, I'm not sure it would work. I can't picture it in my mind, but who knows? I mean, Tudor probably knows better than me what sells and what they can make. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see.
In my mind, these watches really kind of call back to, you know, the Tudor divers from way back. And I think blue in that zone would make sense. And I also think that in a realm where we've kind of come, what is it even fair to call it Fotina anymore,
mm-hmm.
depending on the watch on a Pelagos, it probably isn't.
Yeah.
Like the LHD, can you really call a watch that's that decidedly modern? Do you still call the color of its loom Fotina? Probably not. Right.
Right.
It's just they went with a warmer tone for the loom.
Yeah.
And you could see them kind of going with more of a flat or, you know, controlled sunburst sort of blue in reference to something like the classic Snowflakes, right? That had that blue coloring. Yeah. So that could be cool. Who knows? I think it's more likely that we'll see an expansion of something like the BB58 GMT into a new colorway. Simply because I feel like the playbook for the 58s is very solidified. Black and gold.
Yeah.
Next one's blue, you know.
All right. Well, all things Tudor. I'm excited to catch this this episode along with everybody else later this week after you've had a chance to talk to Cole. And, you know, before you dive into it, you know, here's a hearty hello from Minneapolis to you, Cole. Good to have you on the show. It's great.
I will certainly pass that on to Cole. And for those of you who might be too new to this world, of course, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you. Cole Pennington is a former colleague of mine from Hodinkee. He's a world traveler, a strong photographer, an absolute watch and car nerd, and just has become a good buddy of mine over the years. A few years back, he left Hodinkee and moved to Switzerland to take on a role with Tudor. And I think that was a wild move at the time for him. And I think that's largely why the Cole, you know, one's kind of dialed down. He had a lot of other work to do. We were no longer spending a lot of time in the same place. It's quite a treat when I get to see Cole these days. And obviously there's the Tudor side of it, and we'll get into that to a certain extent. But really the stuff I want to talk to is, I mean, like, Cole's one of the most American guys I know. You know, one of New Jersey's finest sons, you know, has lived all over, has a real love for like places that I really feel are deeply American, the Florida Keys, the Rockies, you know, Louisiana and Mississippi and these sorts of spots. And, you know, we bonded over having had some shared experience or split experiences there. And then we did a Road Through America series for Hodinkee together in California. And over the years, I've gotten to really love Cole and appreciate his friendship and, you know, his very specific type of wisdom is the type that I don't possess. And I think I'm really keen to ask him a lot of questions about what it's like to try and make a go in Switzerland. Like, I think there's a lot of people that love watches that kind of think, I'd be interested to know what that's like.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then at the same time, it's not like you're going to some scrappy independent or even a sort of brand that's part of a major group or something like that. This is Tudor. I mean, you've got to fit into a corporate structure with Rolex. I'm sure there's lots of rules and all that kind of stuff. So I'm really curious to dig into some of that kind of stuff. But Cole's an old friend, a consummate, Hodinkee alum, watch writer, travel writer, video host. If you haven't seen, and I'll put it in the show notes, if you haven't seen his original Watches in the Wild series, it remains one of the better things we've ever produced. And he did the majority of it himself, which is lovely. And yeah, he remains a good buddy and he works for a brand that we really like. And, you know, he made a leap that I think a lot of people, myself included, would be kind of too scared or too unsure of the risk to make. And I think that's something that I'm looking forward to digging into. So here it is, his fourth appearance on TGN. It's Cole Pennington. You were on.
Wow.
But I do think, unless my math is wrong, and let's be clear, sometimes it is, I do think you're the only person to cross the 4 threshold. This is CP4.
CP4. So that, firstly, that's an honor. Like, amazing. 176 episodes. You guys have come a long way.
Kind of a run, keeping up with the audience, and you pop into the Slack every now and then and that sort of thing. What was it like?
Idea, yeah.
I'll just dive right in.
Yeah,
we've got a bunch of stuff to get into.
First, let me cheers you real quick.
Here. Oh, okay. Yeah. Cheers, my friend.
Hey, cheers. Good to be back.
A pleasure. We've got a drink around our very cool headsets. Cole and I look like a couple of I don't know, helicopter pilots, maybe.
Yeah, I was thinking more like astronauts.
Oh, yeah, great, because they would just have the headset for radio comms.
We look cool. Got a face for radio.
To this little chat is, what was it like to go from a part of the world where, you know, you were largely doing your own thing with Hodinkee, covering watches, running your own sort of programs with Watches in the Wild and that sort of thing, and then moving halfway around the world, or in some ways all the way around the world,
we did. And it's a good thing you're asking now, 3 years later, 3.5 years later, because the answer during the first year would have been much different. And looking back, I don't think I fully understood what any of it meant, because when you do this, like you have you have the first level. Okay. The job is different. What you do for the majority of your time is different. Then there's the sort of cultural adjustments to make. So like you, I had been coming to Switzerland a good bit for work, right? Mm-hmm. And you think you know a place, but it turns out you really don't at all. Like, I thought I had a decent understanding of Switzerland.
Right.
And to be totally honest, when I was coming here for work, of course, brands sponsor the trips and they kind of put together itineraries for you. So everything you do is programmed. So I thought I had this idea of what Switzerland was like. Then I get there and like, I'm not on a program. I have to make my own program. Life. It's so, so, so different. Hmm. And it's a big question to tackle. So running your own thing to going to corporate culture, we'll address that first. Everything, all the rumors and all the mythos around this organization. It's all true and then some. That's the craziest thing to me. Like, but a lot of folks are off the mark on a good number of things. But then there's this sort of like, all right, it's shrouded in secrecy. I didn't know much about it going in, right? An opportunity comes along. You take the opportunity. Buy the ticket, take their eye, as they say. Then you go inside, and then you spend some time, and then you finally realize why, or you kind of like, you do become indoctrinated, but you discover that there is a rationale behind everything. So that transition was, at Hodinkee, I went from like wearing like what I am now, which is a Patagonia fleece.
It's covered in fish.
Yeah, a little, it's called salmon energy, big salmon energy. And to wearing a suit and tie every day. And at that time, actually, the corporate policy, I'm not sure if it was written down or not, but was like, you have to shave. So suit, tie, shave. You really are like a corporate guy. There is a standard to uphold. That has since been relaxed. I'm allowed to have a beard now. Allowed not to wear a tie. But either way, like that adjustment, it actually didn't hurt. Like, because I think early on I found a sense of purpose and meaning in the organization. And contrary to what we might think of, it's this huge corporate machine. Actually, your impact on the brand, again, it'll never be known, but you do or you can have a real impact on the development of something that's actively growing. So that trade-off of like, you know, building fires in the woods and all the stuff we talked about, you know, like the kind of like free-willing lifestyle to now going to a 9-to-5, which interestingly enough in Europe, which was also a discovery to me, it really is 9-to-5. Yep. Like you don't take work home with you. Yeah, exactly. And that was welcome. And over the course of the last 3.5 years, I will say I've kind of adopted a more European mindset to working. Like when you work hard, you work effectively, efficiently, but then you take time off and it actually makes you better. So yeah, I don't know. There's so much. I think the strategy here will be, let's answer the question as we go into it. Cause there's a lot.
I think that's a perfectly good intro. And I think the other side of it is like not just working for Tudor, but also assimilating into Switzerland. Like it feels like a country that, you know, there was an era where you and I probably would have, or not probably would have, did sit around a table and tease Geneva about not being as cool as other cities.
Yeah, the $8 Coke or whatever.
But I mean, even just like you go like, what is this city? What's going on here? Where do I have to go to have certain experiences? Are those experiences even available, et cetera? And then you meet a couple people, like obviously we have Andy Hoffman here in the city. And I've spent like a couple days in Geneva with him, and it's in a fantastic city.
It's cool.
It's just kind of inscrutable at its base. Somebody has to help you get through like the first layer.
It's almost by design. So they say, like, when you live there, there are two Genevas. One is Genève, which is Genevois people, and it's their society. It exists entirely in French, and it is very insular. Then there is International Geneva, or Geneva, which right. is UN, all the NGOs.
Because some of the places you've taken me feel like spots that I grew up where they just speak a different language and the architecture looks a little different.
That's the idea. Like,
because it's very agricultural. It's very rural in many ways. Like maybe not Geneva, but like it doesn't take that long to leave the part of Geneva that you experienced doing a trade show here.
Put it this way. I can bike to work in 10 minutes, which is more or less downtown Geneva. That's 10 minutes one direction. The other direction, like 30 seconds, you're hearing cows and sheep and stuff. So if you think about that, Rolex, Tudor, HQ, within 13 minutes biking or even like from there, maybe 10 minutes biking, you're in agricultural Switzerland. And one thing, coming there as a American, kind of landing in Geneva, but then thinking I live in Switzerland as opposed to I live in Geneva, you kind of think of the whole country as something to explore, whereas people in Switzerland stay in their language regions. There's something called the Rösti line or Rösti, you know, that fried potato thing, which is French on one side, German on the other side. And like when you cross that, it's an entirely different world. And I was lucky to land in this place where I actually didn't see, or I didn't have the cultural constructs to, you were able to naturally transcend cultural constructs, because people from Geneva just don't really go outside Geneva, you know, or even the French speaking part. So weekend trips to Zurich, then down to Ticino, the Italian part, which is my favorite part of Switzerland, were normal. But then you talk to coworkers and they're like, oh yeah, I've never been to Locarno, or I've never been to Uri, Canton Uri, which is like kind of like the weird mountain.
And people, like, you know? Judging from your Instagram, like, you're spending weekends exploring anywhere you can get quickly from Geneva, which is a pretty broad spectrum of places.
It is. It's
up to and including Africa.
Yeah. So there was that was a thing, driving from Geneva to Morocco. And the idea there was actually to get to, so I know you do this too, because we think alike, but one day looking on a map and seeing this area called Western Sahara, which is sort of like a disputed territory between Morocco and Algeria.
Okay.
And Laayoune is the capital of that. And it's the most remote place in terms of the distance between that city and the next city is the furthest. And I was thinking, I got to go here. I got to go to Western Sahara. So we didn't make it. My wife and I packed up the truck. We kind of, I sketched it out, sketched out the route, and found that, okay, you can take a ferry from the tip of Spain, Algeciras, which is right next to Gibraltar, which, by the way, very underrated. Like, I didn't even think about Gibraltar. I've heard of the Rock of Gibraltar, this and sure. That, but like
a good footnote in Shadow Divers, Gibraltar.
Oh yeah, exactly.
That's where the submarine was believed to have been sunk.
That's right. And I would say, like, it's worth going there, by the way, as a side note. It's just weird hearing, like, seeing those red double-decker buses, the phone booths, but in Spain, some people have a Spanish accent. Weird place, but cool place. And I went to this place called Toyota Gibraltar on the way there. But anyway, yeah, you can drive from Geneva down to Africa. And once you're inside Africa, you can even get to sub-Saharan Africa. And I hate using, like, Africa as a catch-all for everything, because it was specifically the Maghreb region, like Algeria, Morocco, so forth. But that trip was pretty cool. That was a really, really interesting one where, like, you can do something like, you can drive 18 hours in the States and you'll end up somewhere culturally different, but not like another continent. So yeah, anyway, from Geneva, you can do all that. And the funny thing is, I don't think a lot of people do, actually. The other thing too, the Swiss franc is, everything inside the country is very expensive. Then it becomes much more affordable the second you cross the border in any direction.
Right.
So you get a little bit more mileage that way too. So you can think about it, and this is, I would call this like dude math or whatever, but it's cheaper to travel than it is to stay in the country.
I mean, that's a good zone for you.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, you make the leap from, at the time it was New York or Utah, like you were all kind of all over the country in the last couple of years that you're in the States, and you had a variety of hobbies that were kind of linked with what was available there, but you come here, it's a whole different lifestyle. Like you said, it's a true 9-to-5. Like, how have your hobbies expanded? How have you kind of explored some of the things you can do? You know, you last time I was out here in November, not that far from where you live, we drove to France and had a burger on the top of a mountain. Like, it's a whole kind of different scene. How is that kind of reflected in what you're doing outside and spending your time doing?
Good question. Like, the Swiss have their way of doing things. They all love hiking. Mm-hmm. They all take a week off and go skiing. And like, it's much easier. In the beginning, I tried to replicate my American lifestyle, sort of a freewheeling way of life, just kind of doing whatever, not planning much. The second you start going with the way they've set it up, it gets much easier and much more enjoyable. And I'd say, like, some verticals in life, cycling, better in Swiss. Why? The roads, the way they separate cars and cyclists, much better. Just the overall maintenance of the roads, or the respect for pedestrian cyclists and so forth, operates at a much higher level. So that was great. Like, that kind of went up, and I became more interested in that and started to do it more.
And we'll get to it in a moment because you're in the middle, but you have a bike that we should talk about.
Yeah. It's, we will.
Very cool.
And then that connects to a whole other story,
cool.
But we'll
all
get
right.
There.
Yeah, cool.
Other things, like, for instance, diving, something both you and I are into, actually haven't done nearly as much at all. And that's because you're in well, if you're staying in Switzerland, you're in Alpine lakes.
Yep.
Which I hate cold water. I hate cold anything.
You do hate cold everything. This is true.
Or you're in like...
Yeah, we're right on the banks of Lake Neuchâtel. And...
I know where you're going.
It's wicked cold. I was looking because I brought my bathing suit. I thought it was going to be more like 10 or 12 Celsius. It's like 5.
For a Canadian, that's
cold for a swim. It's different for like a dunk in and get out sort of scenario. For me, everybody's different. Everybody could be cooler than me or whatever. But there is also a cement shark in the lake.
Ah, that's cool.
I'll include it. I will say that if you have thalassophobia, if you don't like the idea of sharks, that sort of thing, it's genuinely creepy. It was put down there for divers, and it's like this very exaggerated sort of caricature of a shark. And if you weren't prepared, I think you'd get real freaked out if you just came across this in the green waters of Neuchâtel.
That would be.
Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes. It's pretty goofy looking, this but also looking, pretty scary.
Let's come back.
We should do that some
point. Yeah, in a few months. Yeah. When everything's warm.
Summer.
Yeah, summertime. Yeah, diving, not as much. I mean, and you do have access to the Mediterranean and all that stuff, but I don't know why. It just is not as accessible in a way, or I haven't been equipped with the right entrees into it, you know?
But like with diving, it really does come down to having another person who wants to do it as badly as you do.
So you're in another continent, so we're not going diving anymore.
I dove a ton when I was in Vancouver because I had two or three dive buddies who were like, Saturday, let's get to it, for sure. Yeah. I'll not do anything else on a Saturday. Was before my, you know, kids were older and all that kind of thing. So yeah, it's diving can be a tough one because it's not necessarily the same as going on a hike, going on a run, going on a bike.
It takes a little bit more. And so, but this conversation will spur maybe a resurgence in interest and so forth. So there's that. Then car culture. So this one's pretty interesting.
Because this has been a challenge for you. Like this is one of the first things we talked about. They have a lot of rules here for cars. You come from somewhere that has almost no rules, as do I.
Yeah.
You can own as many cars as you like. You can kind of just leave them on your front yard if you want to. That's not a thing here.
No.
Everything is taxed
to
try and make sure that there aren't too many cars on the road, to make sure that you're not causing too much damage to the environment, to make sure that you're not, that your enjoyment of a vehicle isn't taking away from anybody else's enjoyment of their vehicle. And that's not really the North American perspective on cars that make power or have fun or slide around or all that kind of stuff. Pollute. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. You know, two things. I've been told two phrases that play into exactly what we're talking about. Number one, Switzerland, they say, is a coin-operated country. You put money in the machine and things happen. So there is that notion. The second thing that I heard from a buddy, he said, Switzerland is the best place for car people, but the worst place for cars.
Or drivers. Yeah.
I've heard that. The craziest stuff in the world is here. Like literally within a probably 20-mile radius.
Some of the most remarkable car collections in the entire world are in Switzerland.
Which is crazy. And they
car enthusiasm is a big deal here.
It is. But like
driving like a maniac is not.
Yeah. Well, number
having one, unfettered access to the road.
You will not believe how many tickets I've gotten. Like it's insane. It's thousands and thousands of francs and by conversion more in dollars. Everything like, yes, you're not driving fast, but in a way, like I came here as a kind of square peg in a round hole thing, but slowly I've understood why these rules, they work. Like when you're out on a bike, you know, no one's going to nail you, you know? And also you think about like back home, like rolling coal or like these street takeovers they do, or people, you know, like just raw hiding these hoopies
squatted
around
trucks.
Yeah, exactly. And I kind of see why that's not great, but at the same time, the American in me is like, well, they have the right to do whatever they want, you know?
Yeah, it's a certain type of freedom and it becomes a certain type of art.
Yeah, exactly.
But it is often the type that takes away from somebody else's enjoyment of the road.
And here, so there is the Concours d'Elegance level stuff, and that happens, and that's what we all see from the outside.
Some great museums.
Yeah, amazing car museums. We see like the outside world sees like the Ice St. Moritz and like all of these crazy multi-million dollar cars and stuff. You really have to look another level or two deeper, but the sort of like TGN enthusiasm totally does exist here. It takes a long time to tap into. And it, sure, there's a language barrier, but even beyond that, it's so private. Like, I think in the States, it's very easy to connect with other people through enthusiast groups. You just kind of know them through enthusiasm. Here, even still, it's very cliquish. And you really have to seek out, like, for me, the Land Cruiser community and so forth, it's there. But, like, you really, it doesn't come to you. You really got to work to access that.
Well, there's also a barrier to entry for anybody to like, have a Land Cruiser versus something else, something smaller displacement, something smaller, lighter on the road, that sort of thing. So you can understand that people might be a little bit more guarded about how it plays. That's kind of like human nature.
And it's also the Swiss way is to never sort of put that forth. Like, you don't, you whisper, you don't scream about things, right, in general. So there is that. But speaking of small displacement cars, I want to get into this crazy story.
You were teasing this earlier, so I've been lightly prepped, but I have no clue what I'm about.
I'm excited to tell you this because it's kind of cool. It'll appeal to our collector mindset. I'm out on a bike ride after work, a loop that I do in my neighborhood. So I live in Vessey, which is a suburb of Geneva. And there's a little auto repair shop on the corner, kind of like back in North America, like those little gas station repair shops you see. I'm passing by the local garage, and this guy is backing in an E36 to a spot. And this garage...
Coupe, sedan?
Compact. So even
oh, okay.
You know, the little three-door guy.
Yeah, yeah.
So pretty rare.
Like a 318 Ti, but...
But I'll get different. To that. Yeah. It's one that was only in Europe, which okay. I didn't even know about. So... Basically, this place is cool. Like, I always look at what they have, and I've talked to the guy before. So I see him back it in. I, you know, put on the brakes, and I go to him, oh, cool car. What is it? And we start chatting. So I pull around back and look. It's a 316i with Alaska blue paint, which is kind of like Estoril blue, like the classic BMW color, and a blue fabric interior.
Huh.
So blue on blue.
Yeah.
316i. And I didn't know that this existed. So I talked to him. And again, obviously, different in French, broken English, da 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 da. My French is terrible. So he tells me an old lady got her keys taken away by her children after spending 3,000 francs on fixing up this car, which looks visibly old, like beyond being an E36 and looking old, like the plastic trim is faded to gray. It looks like it's a little older. There's some wear and tear on it. So he tells me, yeah, the children took the keys away and they want nothing to do with this car anymore. And I'm like, so are you selling it? He's like, I don't know. Make me an offer. I go, 1,000 francs. And he goes, 900 and you got a deal. I'm like, whoa, 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 wait a sec. First, let me like take it for a test drive. Or, like, can you show me that it works? Like, doesn't need anything. He pulls out the registration of the car, which, yes, the birthday of the original owner is in the early 30s, 1930s. And the address is right down the street from me. And it shows one owner. And throws me the keys. We go for a drive. It drives great. And I'm like, in this,
what an era for BMW.
I was never really a BMW guy, but like in this snap second, I had to make a decision. Like, this is 900 francs, which is, I don't know, maybe $1,100 or something like that. Do this or not?
At that point, it has very little to do with what the car costs and what it brings to your life in terms of complexity.
So I should have thought about that because that will get.
It's the only reason I don't own like 15 cars.
Well,
because the cars are never that expensive, but you have to put them somewhere. You
well,
gotta register
here
them,
they are expensive.
Yeah, like, that's what, but I mean, like the car itself, the 900 francs or whatever is one number.
That exactly. But
the life cycle of this vehicle is a different number.
And so here you're going to pay CO2 penalty tax, but I ended up having to pay a much larger tax, which I'll get to in a second. But so shake hands with the guy, buy the car. And my wife is away on a business trip. She comes home. There's a new car. I have to explain that, like, oh yeah, we have this pretty cool car. Like, hey, it comes from Europe. It was only sold in Europe, never came to the States. And so it is a 1.6 liter
okay
motor, puts out 102 horsepower. It is a hatchback, but rear wheel drive. And it has E30 suspension in the rear, E36, typical E36 suspension in the front. So it was kind of a hybrid of the two generations, being that it was like, the idea was a compact city car that was very affordable for people at the time.
But really, gave them the BMW touch and feel.
Exactly.
The steering wheel, the buttons, the dashboard, that's
right. And a great motor, rear wheel drive, a nice gearbox. So
a 5-speed or 6?
5-speed. Yeah. So this car really fit into that like European zeitgeist, which BMW obviously in the States and Canada and so forth is more of a luxury product and everything. So buy this car, and this links up to the next story, which I might as well just get into. So
sure, yeah, let's do it.
We'll start with the bike. Buy the car and then take the car down to Italy to pick up a bike that I had sort of commissioned, so to speak, back in July.
Yeah, and we talked about this in November because it was just about done.
Yes, exactly. And then it took some time to pick up and so forth, to get down there and finishing touches and yada, yada, yada. But
so I think the bike folks in the audience should pay attention. This sounds like a cool, I don't know enough about bikes to be like, but when you list it, I'll write it out and send it to my dad and he's going to be thrilled.
The idea is, okay, you're in Europe. There are great cycling roads here or whatever. I love titanium, as do you. Plagas 39, titanium everything. Exactly. And I Google around and find this. There's things like Passoni, which is like $10,000 for a frame. But the idea was, okay, you can buy once, cry once, right? Like buy the best thing one time and you can have it for life because titanium never dies. It doesn't rust, doesn't rot. It just is, you know? So I thought, okay, I'm going to get a custom frame made and I'm going to do this once. Yes, it's going to be expensive, but like, let's just do it. Let's do it and let's be happy forever is the goal, right? Look around. There's things like Passoni, which will cost $10,000. Then there's things at like $5,000. But one of the most affordable options and has sort of a deep history is Gios or Gios, G-I-O-S, Torino. So Torino and Milan were really the bicycle manufacturing capitals of Italy. I'm sure you've heard of Cinelli. Like Cinelli is from Milan. Turin, obviously, also being the industrial capital for automotive culture, they also did bicycle manufacturing. So three generations of frame builders have existed in Turin. I call the guy and I ask him, you kind of do like an interview, like when you want to do something custom or start this project. And yeah, we get on great. He's cool. And the thing is, on the phone, we both get stoked. And I told him I would like more or less, it ended up being a gravel bike. But the idea was just an aggressive for gravel geometry with clearance for up to like 45 millimeter tires. So, because in Swiss, there's gravel all over the place, farm tracks mixed with roads. So the idea was, you could one bike to do everything. Like, build your dream bike, just get it done with. So go down there and take the truck, but decide to make a little bit of a trip out of it. So we go down there, we pull up in front. And the other thing too is I'd been going to Turin plenty, but pull up to the frame builder shop and we have our work stuff, clothes for the weekend trip or whatever in the truck. We go in, I get measured up for the frame. The stoke is high, like, this is awesome. Come outside to the truck. And, and the other thing, too, I brought a couple of bikes down with me so that we can use some of the geometry measurements. Basically, like, okay, this works. I like riding this, so let's incorporate that into design. Additionally, I was going to take off some parts and leave them there and so forth. So three bikes total. And then two suitcases full of stuff. So we walk out to the car, and the barn door in the back is swung open. I'm like, that's weird. That's kind of weird. I walk around. I see the back window punched out. I'm like, do a quick assessment and inventory of what's gone. All the bikes are gone. The bikes are totally gone. And I think, okay, whatever. Not whatever. Like, it sucks. And those bikes, one was a Van Dessel, which is pretty special, New Jersey brand that I got bought out or something. But my wife's weekend bag with her passport. Because, you know, when you go,
that's into always the concern. And you're the man that taught me to always have it in your pocket.
Yes. Because, and that's the thing.
You want my passport? You have to rob me for it, is how I operate.
There will be a fight. So the passport's gone, laptop's gone, everything's gone. So we go to the Volpiano police station, we file a report, but it's like, Volpiano is a suburb of Turin, which is, there's no English there. And it's some whole big thing. We're going to go back to the States and not so long after that. So we have to get an emergency passport in Bern, yada, yada, yada. So it was a whole big thing. So there's a big price to pay for this frame. So it better be worth it, right? Like, we went through this horrible situation and...
Now you're two bikes down.
Yeah.
Three bikes, a passport, a rear window.
Laptop, yeah. And the thing is, for that truck, you can't just get a...
Like, this is a modern Series 70.
Yeah, modern 70 series, so a GRJ 76. The only modern thing about it is the ABS system, some of the airbags. Yeah, anyway... Everything got cleaned out. Then, so that happened. It's bad, right? Now to go pick up the bike, instead we take the BMW. Because, hey, you just bought this 900 franc BMW. Let's go use it. Yeah, road trip, baby.
I do believe there's something really pure and perfect about getting a car, as it doesn't matter how reliable you believe it to actually be, and immediately giving it a long-distance test.
Yeah, that's the best way to shake it down, right?
Well, also, like, the worst case is you break something that was going to break in your day-to-day life.
Mm.
That's a big pain when you, like, have to be at work or get your kids to whatever your tasks are in life. But if you just take a couple days and you go, I'm going to drive this 2,000 kilometers and something breaks on the path, you kind of expect it. It's like getting up to run an old Italian car on a Saturday morning. Like, if it breaks, it breaks.
It's part of the ownership experience.
It's part of the ownership experience. And you're not combining that breakage with other stress in your life. It's like you make an island out of the stress.
I will take this and sort of fashion my next trip using this advice.
I mean, we talked very briefly earlier in this episode about my Wrangler, and you and I spoke about my Wrangler earlier today, and I can't decide what to do. But one of the things is, I would like, you know, my brother lives in the middle of nowhere, kind of in BC. Maybe just drive it out to him.
Yeah.
He would enjoy having a stick. There's room for lots of vehicles.
Trans-Canada Highway?
Yeah, for sure. You take Trans-Canada. I mean, he's near Nelson, BC.
Oh, of course, Nelson.
And Nelson, yeah, everybody knows, for sure. It's not quite the full middle of nowhere, but you're moving. You're in the middle of the middle of nowhere. You know, you're on an ancillary part of the middle of nowhere.
It'll give you a story.
Yeah, I think this is the life cycle of a certain type of vehicle. It's like, if you buy a $900 weird BMW, you should put some mileage on it.
So... one of the times that we park it, it's all good. Actually, it starts, it's reliable, and it's a purposefully detuned motor.
A well-serviced E36.
It was.
Might have some sticky buttons, but otherwise it should be pretty good.
And that, so I thought. So come out to the car one of the times, stick the key in, start it up, nothing happens. And I'm not getting fuel or spark. So I'm wondering, I don't know what this is. I try and do like a quick assessment. I look at the fuse box, all the fuses are good. I just don't know. Some college kids, it's right near a college campus. College kids are walking by. I'm like, hey, can you help give me like a little clutch kick start, you know? And like, yeah, can you help push and I'll do this. Try it a bunch of times, it doesn't work. So basically kind of stranded in Turin and left it at some random Italian shop in like the industrial area. Come back a week later, 350 euros later, I ask him, so what was it? Hey, it's working. No problem. Perfetto. Okay. Okay. You take the car. And I go.
Fuel pump?
It was the EWS system. So it was like a little, the engine immobilizer had been activated because this chip had degraded or corroded or whatever. But yeah, 350 euros. Back on the road, baby.
30% of its purchase value.
Yeah, exactly. And and that was that. And that was cool. And it kind of made me feel young again in a way. But also, like, this bike has been nothing but stress in terms of, like, getting everything stolen, this and that. So, yeah, a new car, new bike. Those are very
TGM
things.
So how is the bike?
Bike is great. So that's interesting. Yes.
Walk people through the build. We know it's a titanium frame.
Okay, gravel, titanium frame, Didachi. Titanium tubing with also Didachi dropouts.
Okay.
And it uses, so there's two people, two TGNers who have to think. One is Evan Perrone. He writes about watches every now and then for Warren and Round.
Okay.
And great dude. He helped me source some of the parts and so forth. And then Justin Satters, our man, kind of offered the inspiration or how do you go about tackling this? So the build is SRAM Force Electronic.
Okay.
So I'm usually like, I love cables, I love the mechanical actuation. But if I'm going to do this, might as future-proof it or might as well do that. And
I've never even ridden a bike with the electronic.
Yeah, it's really good. Yeah. I want it to not like it, but it's actually really, really, really good.
Is it like the PDK of...
It is.
Yeah.
It's okay. Like snap, like bang, bang, bang. The gears are... Zzz, zzz,
zzz. Oh, that's cool. Okay.
It's really, really good. And then, the guy who built the frame only uses Italian parts. I brought him some SRAM, some American parts. But for everything I didn't have, he only said I can use Italian parts. So it's like, it's full Sella Italia, again, Didacci, all this stuff. Or Detta, I guess, is the brand of that. But so gravel build, it's 47 millimeter wide tires. So it looks like they're thick and chunky, but it has these.
Not quite cruiser, but on the way.
It kind of looks like that. And yes, it sounds like kind of bratty or whatever, but like, if you can get a custom geometry bike, it really does make all the difference. Because I got on it for a test ride, I'm like, this actually feels different. Like, it feels completely different. And he took all my measurements, and then when I finally picked it up, he had already set saddle height and everything. And I got on it, I'm like, so this is what it should feel like. People talk about, like, you get a professional bike fit, and it kind of changes the game. It's entirely true. And then the next level is you get a custom frame. It changes the game. So really, really cool build. So it's 1x13. So one chainring in the front, right? Which is, I think, a 42 tooth. And then the rear, it's 13 speeds. So that, and this is really from the gravel side of things, not road, right? Road purists would say you need a double chainring up front, compact.
Yeah, whatever, yeah. Yeah, when they built that bike on speed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They did a single front, and as someone who like doesn't like the complexity, I have my bike is a it's three front sprockets, and most of the time I'll just leave it in the toughest one, and then use a little bit.
So
of the
you're
back.
Using one by,
yeah,
10 or
and like I totally get it, and then in my mind it was just like, why wouldn't everybody like this? And I mentioned it on the TGN Slack, and it just created like a 50 thread of people being like, well, there's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't do that and why people don't do that.
But I think we're seeing, at least.
It made sense to me. It still does.
This will happen. One buy is the future. And when you ride it, you realize like, yeah, this is awesome.
One less thing to think about. One less piece of mechanical.
And also, like, not going to lie, the aesthetics are pretty cool.
Oh, too. Yeah, for sure.
Like, it just looks
the
good.
Noise.
Yeah.
That front derailleur.
Yeah, no front derailleur.
At least on my simple, very inexpensive bike, it's like noisy and rattly.
Yeah, and like, I don't know. So that bike, Geos Torino, and yeah, they really do cool work. They're more like a historic brand than like a forward-looking brand.
Right.
But for this one, we kind of pushed the design a little bit. You know, it's kind of the one tool to do it all. You can throw some road wheels on it, or you can keep the gravel wheels on it. And it really, it's just the go-to. You could have just this bike.
And swapping wheels, not that big of a task.
Easy.
Yeah,
breezy.
Yeah,
yeah,
okay.
It's a through axle.
Right, okay. Yeah, same.
And yeah, that's why I would say that. And titanium. So it's a GADA or G-A-D-A. I don't know how to say that. It's a GATA bike, like a GATA watch, you know?
And how long have you been riding it then?
Great question. Not long. Like,
okay.
2 weeks.
2 weeks, and yeah. It's a daily thing you get to spend time on?
Ride it every
this
day.
This is you're taking it to work?
Yep, riding it to work, coming home, even in the rain. So I'm doing Strada Bianchi.
Have you had, like, any bike guys be like, anyone notice at the office at the bike pool?
No, but I'm waiting for that.
Yeah,
but
sure,
everyone is into it. So like, I'm hoping someone's like, oh, yo, dude, someone has a sick bike in the parking lot. We have like a little bike parking lot. And I'll be, oh, yeah, that's a Geos Torino custom frame, you know. But no, not yet. So you're the first guy to give it props. So thank you.
Well, that's great, man. I'm it's something that like I feel we talked about when you first started the project. And then when I saw you in November, we hung out for a couple days. when I was out here for the auctions and everything else, and we went to a car show. Or yeah. I thought it was going to be a car show, and then it ended up just being like a used car lot, but like a Swiss-style one. But then we went and looked at military surplus, and we got some foie.
Yeah.
It was a pretty good day.
That was fun.
Yeah,
that was
pretty good day as far as all those things go. The project has been going for a while, so I'm glad that you've got it, and it's like you're 2 weeks in, and you're not like, I kind of wish I had gone a different direction.
I would probably like not park the car there, maybe not take BMW. Like there are certain things I wouldn't do, but I wouldn't change a thing with the build. And I will say,
like, put some tint on the Land Rover.
Yeah. Well, it is. It's completely blacked out.
Oh, I didn't remember that.
Yeah, front two windows are clear, but then the rest is completely blacked out. So they just got lucky. They popped one and got lucky. But
I guess I've only been in it at night.
Yeah, you have.
Because we had the exceptional Blazer.
That's right.
That was last out with you.
That's maybe one of the few running early 2000s Blazers in all of Europe.
Almost certainly.
Yeah. One of the coolest things to drive around. You feel like that's, and for us, that was like a high school icon. And it really has become a cultural fixture of the early 2000s, like Tony Soprano-esque, like in the American car scene in the early 2000s, a Chevy.
Yeah, like Meadows' boyfriend probably drove.
Yes, exactly.
And I want to call it a K-Series. My brain wants to go. It's the one, after
K-Series. I don't know. K-Series,
I had a K-Series. I had an 89 two-door.
Oh,
with the 4.3.
Nice, yes.
Such a huge motor to make about the same horsepower as your 1.6. I think it made 112 horsepower, something like that. I've never owned a vehicle so bad on fuel.
That was the
4.3 V6. Good vehicle. Paid a dollar for that one. Full dollar. Had to sign that affidavit and all that. I bought it off an uncle. But yeah, I don't know my GM bodies well enough, but you know, it was the one that was also like the pickup truck that was quite popular for a long time.
Yeah, the S10 Chevy S10.
Yeah, like an S10. The later generation of the S10. You could get them with a 5-speed. My brother had a red 5-speed S10 in Squamish for some time. Yeah, good vehicles. But yeah, you had this one from a colleague that you were driving around, and it was just, you know, it wasn't maybe designed for going up and down the French Alps to get to our burger spot, but we had fun.
But it made it, and it was good.
I would say, in my mind, the problem was the headlights. You know, stock headlights from early 2000s in the U.S. were pretty tough.
Yeah, and we were climbing Mount Saleve in the not even the Jurs. I don't know what they are.
I guess it's definitely not the French Alps.
But. Yeah, well, actually, it's closer to the Alps than it is the Jurs, but. But yeah, that was and in the middle of the night, there's zero like lighting infrastructure or anything like that.
We did fine.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun.
And if you want to have a burger up on top of a mountain next to a very like Stranger Things coated tower,
yes,
I will put it in the show notes.
It's rad. It's a lot. We had a good time.
Burger was great.
Yeah, burger's great. Solid.
And I'm incredible. It's one of the few pieces of food I'm really picky on.
And chicken wings, of course.
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, come on. Yeah.
Mine are wing bar. I mean, no, Smith Street or stay at my own house.
No mediocre chicken wings are getting past James.
Nah, it's not going to work. But yeah, man. I mean, this is fun. I have it every time you bring something new up, it kind of like unravels something. But the other thing that we've been chatting about just today is the culmination of years of work on a car.
Oh my God. So
you're getting videos at dinner of your buddy and a guy that has become my buddy through you, Franco, getting a vehicle back to your parents' place in New Jersey.
Okay,
and this is a cool car.
It's a cool car.
So I would say try and keep it as compressed as possible.
All right, I'm going to keep this very
compressed. But like, what's the time? How long have you had this car? Because I remember when you got it, but yeah. I want to say 21?
Yes.
Okay.
2021. And I remember taking the train home and calling you and telling you about it.
Oh, it's very cool. Gray Alpha with red seats.
Gray Alpha blue seats.
Oh, blue. Blue. Okay. So oh, maybe like, it was a red
the red seatbelts. Okay, yeah, exactly. Okay. So the gray-blue thing, I don't know if it came from this, but there was NART or North American Racing Team, silver Ferrari, blue seats. And they always use blue seats. So maybe that's what this is from. The compressed version of the story, I wrote a story for Petrolicious. And in the process of that, I was getting a tour of this garage in Philadelphia that was closing. And I saw this Alpha and was just like moved. Asked if it was for sale. Absolutely not. Not for sale.
It's a 59
Alpha Giulietta Sprint.
It's a peach.
It's awesome. And a couple of years later, this was in the late teens, a couple of years later. So like, let's say like 18 in 2021, the guy who I was talking to comes back and says, yeah, the owner wants to sell the car. Are you interested? So I said yes, not really thinking like totally about everything beyond that. Bought it and it sat in my parents' garage forever. And then I moved to another continent. And
you and I talked about me buying it, about finding somebody else to buy it.
So it's like, it can't come here because it's too modified, but it has amazing history. It was raced by a couple of notable people in like the Alpha world or classic car world. And it turns out the owner of the car actually lives in Switzerland right now. Carol Sprague. She entered it into the Carrera Panamericana in 1993. And then Bruce Trenery, the guy behind Fantasy Junction. I don't know if you ever heard of them, but they're like a big West Coast classic car dealer.
Okay.
Raced it in Carrera Panamericana in 94.
Okay.
And it became kind of like a thing in the early 90s and was built by a guy in San Diego. Rob Shanahan, I think is his name, who also is kind of a legendary alpha builder. And I didn't know any of this when I bought it, but throughout the years, and also there's this guy, Connor Golden, who writes for Haggerty and so forth. You might know him as well. He put together a little history of the car and found little bits that I couldn't find. So I discovered all this and I was like, all right, it's time to do something. Got it repaired. And long story short, it was a kind of hurry up and wait thing. So it needed a new fuel cell, because you know those fuel cells, the styrofoam degrades over time, and someone had let, you know, fuel sit in the engine, degrade the fuel cell. So, but it was long enough, because it was built in the early 90s, that ATL, or fuel safe, didn't retain the sketches of the drawing. So we needed to drop it, measure it, have a custom fuel cell made. It was a project. It took years and years and years. And now I'm over here. And Franco actually drove it under its own power for the first time since 2008.
Dude, that's exciting, right?
From the shop to my parents' garage, where
18
now...
18 years.
Yeah, 18 years of sitting around, and now it's refreshed. It's stunning. And now I don't really know what to do with it, because Switzerland, like we talked about, has crazy laws where it has to be the original engine. This is actually a 1750, so a motor from the GTV.
The one to have,
yeah. High revving, really lively and fun. So it's a 1750 dropped into this. It was converted to disc brakes. They put a 5-speed in there. So it's really set up for racing and not really for like...
Disc brakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You and I have both driven your former boss, my current boss, Ben's Zagato 356, which is the best, maybe the best thing I've ever driven in terms of just like pure fun.
Yeah, so good.
But the minute you need to slow down, it's the scariest thing I've ever driven at the same time, which, like, don't get me wrong, my wiring is poor. Scary equals good sometimes. Yeah. But the move to disc brakes, maybe there's a purist argument against it. I'm not there for it.
No, well, if it's actually used in competition, like, you kind of need that, right? But like, that's true. The drum brake thing, you really need to calculate your...
You're just constantly leaving a much bigger buffer.
Yeah, exactly.
And then if something's not quite going your way, suddenly, without any forethought, you're a 2-foot breaker.
Yes.
That's you're exactly just like, right. I'm gonna get, she's going into neutral and I'm using both legs.
Yep.
I'm Lewis Hamilton at the, you know, at the top, really, of the hill, really pushing that in Texas. Yeah.
And yeah, so that car, I need to find something to do with it. And like, I would love to keep it and see. And really what draws me in is the story, like most of the things we like, right? Like, this, it's been around, it did some cool stuff. It went into hibernation for decades. Now it's ready to do its next thing. So whether it's me or someone else, I just want to make sure that it gets used, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I feel you for sure. And look, I don't want to gloss over any of this. I feel like there'll be a CP5, a CP, whenever we get a chance. But we're in Switzerland, and I teased why we were here. I didn't tell everybody what the purpose of this trip is. I did say that it's not the sort of trip I've ever been on before, despite doing this for a long time. And also, it's unlikely that I would ever do it again, in terms of the opportunity to check out what we'll see over the next couple of days. As a way to kind of close out the chat, why don't you give people an idea of what we're talking about, and then I'll give them my impressions on, say, next week's episode.
So today, this very day, 100 years ago, Hans Wilsdorf registered the Tudor. So literally today, as we sit here, it's 100 years old. Well, we say 100 years young, actually. And that's sort of an excuse to do something we've never done before. It's not directly tied to that, but it's worth acknowledging that, yes, today marks 100 years since the founding of Tudor. So you've been to the manufacturer. You've seen how Tudor watches are assembled. So when you go there, it's Tudor on one side, Kinesi on the other side. Kinesi produces the movement. It's a wholly owned company by the group. It goes over next door, and the watch is cased up, and basically assembly happens there. And that's the case for every single Tudor. They come through this facility, this manufacturer in Lalaque. What we have never shown before is everything that happens up until that point. And that is an industrial alliance or a network of suppliers. We call it horizontally integrated, or sort of, where everything comes from somewhere. Some suppliers, again, we haven't really come forth with this, but Tudor owns. Normally, this is more or less trade secrets. It's just things that are never really shown in this world. As you know, it's layers and layers deep. But the idea is finally take you to go see it. So how are the dials made? How is the case made? How does everything get made? So 100% of the parts are made within about an hour to an hour and a half from the manufacturer using a hub and spoke system, right? So suppliers all send their parts to the manufacturer. It gets assembled in the manufacturer. So
this is why the manufacturer that came out a couple years ago, which we did a story on and that sort of thing, for Hodinkee is in Lalaque versus somewhere else.
Well, prior to this, it was all in Geneva. So that's a three-hour trip from the supplier to Geneva. Now imagine,
and it's
all
not
the
hub
parts.
And spoke anymore. It's
no,
this
it's like way out,
cockeyed,
far western, yeah. Well, far west of the suppliers. So you will see throughout the next 2 days, pretty much every single component being made that goes into the watch.
As like a nerd that grew up with how'd this get made?
Yeah. So that's the idea.
Yeah.
It's sort of chronologically follow all of it. And normally in like a independent horology or whatever, that all happens under one roof. Mm-hmm. We don't. And that's for efficiency. That's also to keep the best watch we can sell at the best price. So it's not necessarily that we want to obscure all of the suppliers and everything. It's very transparent in that regard. However, this will be the first and last time that it's shown. And I think what you'll find interesting is, because we've seen it together, you've seen it playing on your own, sort of the romanticized image of independent horology. It gets super interesting, like anything, like scale is interesting in itself. So industrial horology.
Well, also, like, I don't want to be unfair, like, in the modern context, there's this Swiss identity to the independent.
Yeah.
The one guy with his four, you know, apprentices making everything by hand. But like the thing that made Switzerland the country it is for watches is the ability to make a really repeatable product at scale.
Yeah.
And if the demand goes up, the production can go up.
Can scale.
And to
up
do that, you need partners. There's no other manufacturing. Like, look at the way that a car is made, and you know, Canadians and Americans have experienced these sorts of things in the last little while. Across the border several times.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Various things are made. Or when a war breaks out in Ukraine, suddenly you can't get wiring harnesses for VW products. And you go like, oh, yeah, it's because this is all kind of spread out.
Big network.
Other than maybe like the G-Wagon, which was like largely made in Graz.
Austria, yeah.
Like most of this stuff is like really stratified and is made where there's local talents for it. And I think when we... you know, the little bit that I've Googled around what I've learned from Tudor is like some of these things were really longstanding partnerships that Tudor then bought out when it made sense for the business. And others are ones that haven't gotten to that arc in their business structure yet. So they're just partners.
That's right. And one thing too, again, this isn't really like often spoken about because there's brand communication, which makes your brand desirable and positions it correctly. Then there's also the stuff you don't talk about, but are very central to the identity and goals of the group. One of those goals is to buoy and support the entire industry. So that's Hans Wilsdorf Foundation mission. So by securing, we call it, you know, financially securing. It's not acquiring, it's financially securing a supplier That also guarantees that every other brand also gets their parts. Because you remember, again, it's uncouth to go into specifics per se, but there was a point in time where some suppliers kind of like choked off their supply, and many people depended on those movements to continue their business.
Yeah, I think so like 2010 to 2015 at entry-level movements.
Yeah.
There's like a black market for 2824.
Though that kind of thinking, like how can we help buoy the entire industry and make sure, because when Tudor does well, let's reverse it. When watches do well, Tudor does well.
Yeah, like it's that thing that I harp on that sounds ridiculous, but then when you think about it, maybe it's a little bit less than ridiculous. It's like this idea of like a really long play, right? And like companies that can stand to make a decision based on a 20-year schedule will probably see more stable outcomes than a company that has to make a decision based on a 2-year schedule or whatever. And you're celebrating, 100 years of Tudor. Why not start thinking in a 100-year scale, right?
That's the idea. Like and, the idea is really make sure to... It's not company versus company in the watch industry. It's watches versus something else that people want to buy. Like, let's just say like custom titanium frames.
Well, it's like we talked about at dinner tonight with, with several other folks from our world. Like the currency of 2026 in watches is relevancy. People could spend their money any other way or they could just not spend it.
Yeah.
And even if they do spend it, how do you less afflicted, we'll say, depending on how many watches you bought. One, it feels fine.
Yeah, it's fine.
But like, I think there's an argument to be made that like the whole scene around watch enthusiasm is like, how do you stay relevant to that conversation?
Yeah.
And longevity seems to be a major marker in relevancy.
100%.
You know what I mean? So I get it. For sure.
That's exactly it. Because again, I mean, this has been said a million times on a million different watch podcasts, but
there's not something you,
well, not ones that I listen to, but no, I'm kidding.
I only kid. There's lots of great ones.
Yeah, no, there are. But like, it's not something you need to buy. So again, it's a luxury. We almost think of it as, oh, you need one good watch. Like, yeah, sure, that's true. But
it's
also
fun to have one good watch. Fun. Need is a different scenario.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There is no need here. So how do
Casio's got need covered.
Yeah, exactly. Like the low barrier to entry, you can just get it. And your phone has the need covered, right? But it's really the exactly what you said. The long-term vision here is to, if you stick to one simple mantra, which is create the best possible watch at the best possible price, everything else kind of falls into place. And I think that's the idea behind this. And over the next few days, you will see how those decisions were reached in terms of forming an industrial alliance. And this is going to be really business heavy, really industrial manufacturing, a little bit of the business of watches. I should be sitting across from Andy
talking,
instead.
Talking watch podcasts.
Yeah. and also a rare chance to sort of see behind the veil, because the communication strategy is not necessarily, hey, we have all this network of suppliers and so forth. You don't put that forward. But for this occasion, we will. And I'm excited to kind of just experience it with you and look at it through fresh eyes.
Well, hey, look, next couple of days is going to be a lot of fun. Yeah. Dude, it's been a little over an hour here, so I don't want to keep you forever. It's been an absolute treat to have you on, dude. I'm such a fan. Mm-hmm. I'm so happy that you've found a place, even if it is further away from me than you used to be, and we're not in the office together and that sort of thing. We're not doing watches in the wild. We're going to do a version of it tomorrow, yeah. I suppose. Less wild, but the Swiss wilds.
Exactly.
And I'm just looking forward to it. I'm super happy for you, man. And I can't be more happy that we finally got CP4 on the books.
Likewise. And I didn't know that, but like, I'm absolutely honored. And I want to thank you and Jason.
It was almost sincerely half the show ago.
Yeah. That's crazy to think. And like, now I want to go back, engage on the Slack more, and I don't know. Like, I've always been.
I think there'll
guy.
Be some people who really want to see a picture of that bike and maybe some video of you driving it.
We will.
We're gonna get you a GoPro or something.
Yeah, amen. I would love to. And thank you for having me on again. And it's always a pleasure. And yeah, it's just cool to sit across from a friend and talk. And we happen to have these interesting headsets.
The headsets.
We should put a picture of these headsets.
I could maybe that'll be the hero image, just that yeah. snapshot you took of you and I in the headsets. But yeah, dude, it's a treat to have you on. And there's about 10 other things I wanted to get to. We didn't even get to Dakar.
No.
You got to hang out for a couple of days with James Pumphrey and Jesse Wood. Obviously, I'm a huge speed nerd, so that's very cool. But we'll save that for the next one. Thanks so much for being on, dude.
The pleasure is mine, and as always, thank you.
All right. Well, as you know, we're recording this before your conversation with Cole, so I can't say what a great chat with Cole.
Oh, it went really well. The audio quality was amazing, James.
Good job. Yeah. But I am looking forward to hearing this. So, yeah, it's great that you're able to do this, and I will tune in with everybody else and catch it.
Yeah, and a big thank you for Cole to be on and to, you know, Tudor for taking us through the trip that I'm sure that he spoke about on the recording. But yeah, let's stop playing around in three different timelines here. What have you got for final notes this week?
Yeah, this is a fun one. It's a short animated film that was produced and hosted on the New Yorker's website, New Yorker magazine. They have this whole section of their website on short films, which I recently discovered. And this one is called Retirement Plan, and it's only like 7 or 8 minutes long. But I've watched it a couple of times because it's just delightful. It's just this voiceover or sort of I guess captions about like this specific person, this older gentleman who you see kind of moving through the latter years of his life and kind of all these plans that he had made before retirement about things he was going to do, these really ambitious things he was going to do, you know, drink 8 glasses of water a day, learn new skills, travel more, you know, respond to all the emails that he ignored for all these years, you know. And it's the kind of thing that you kind of chuckle while you're watching, and then there's a certain poignancy to it. And I think we can all relate to a lot of it, you know, no matter how old you are or how close or far from retirement you are. You know, we all have these ambitions about things that we say we're going to get to one day. And I think, it's just a delightful little short film, and I just wanted to share that with everybody because I think it's definitely worth 7 minutes of your time.
Yeah, this is cool. I've been playing it just on another screen here while you were chatting, and it definitely has a specific vibe. I like the animation style, and yeah, it looks like he's kind of listing all these things that he plans to do, and I assume that the idea is you're supposed to do them before you run out of time. But
all right, what do you got?
I have two this week. So the two, I'm not sure they could be very different, but two things I discovered kind of in the last few days that I really found some value in. The first one is a pretty wild YouTube video. I mean, as wild as setting up your iPhone can be. But it's from this guy, This Is E. He seems to be a tech YouTuber guy that I don't follow or haven't in the past. I do now. And this is going to be more for the iPhone users among us, although perhaps there's concepts that could be shared into Android. But for the iPhone users, you know, I'm always trying to refine my home screen to be as little as I need to do what I actually need, though. So I'm not constantly searching out an app that I don't want to include on the home screen or the other way around, or, you know, wasted space or not using widgets. So it seems like this guy kind of has a reputation for making these really fantastic videos about how to get like the most out of your setting up your phone for the lock screen, the home screen, the you know, the widget screen, all that kind of stuff. And it's a great video. I'm not saying you necessarily sit down and do everything that he lists, but I learned a ton of stuff in the first five or 6 minutes of this video about things that you could do. I didn't realize you could just easily stack your own widgets, which is a bit of a game changer for the simplicity of my home screen and that sort of thing. So highly recommend this if you're on iPhone and you kind of want to get to the point where you really get to customize the experience. Like, you know, I came from Android years ago where you had a lot more options for making everything feel more like your own or less like you're being pushed down the certain channels of experiences. And then the other thing, and I don't know why I don't some sort of a you know, some sort of a problem in my thinking. But at one point in the video, he says, oh, I disable all of my notifications except for like messages, WhatsApp, and email.
Yeah.
And I was like, at first that hit me as like, well, you must miss so much stuff. And then I said, well, oh, I would like to miss
them. Yeah. Yeah.
So I've gone through and turned off all these notifications that I was getting from random apps during the day.
Yeah.
And like, it's a little weird not to get, you know, headlines from New York Times, but if I have 5 minutes, that's, that like my brain can remember to open that app when I sit down.
Right. Yeah.
And then the second one, like I said, couldn't be that much different. over the weekend, I went down a YouTube rabbit hole of like Irish and Gaelic folk singing, like traditional folk singing.
Yeah.
And I came across, I guess the YouTube thing led me to looking up some Instagram accounts. And then later on, I was just kind of ripping through reels, to getting a chuckle here or there. And I got connected to a couple different clips from Aniar Music, A-N-I-A-R, Aniar might be the pronunciation as well. It's three women. They don't have a huge profile anywhere else. They seem to have TikTok and Instagram. And Jason, I included in the second link there if you want to hear it. But it's just these short clips of them singing. And I had had this song stuck in my head since I saw the movie Sinners, and that's Will You Go, Lassie Go. Which they sing in the film, and these women do a beautiful rendition of it, including a harmonium, which is just a hand-pumped organ, and they're just like sitting in the country, and yeah, and the melodies and the harmonies are incredible. The backgrounds, like everything's great about this, and it's just very relaxing and really beautiful. So I highly recommend that. Again, A-N-I-A-R Music on Instagram, or I guess TikTok. I don't use TikTok, but I couldn't find them on Spotify or YouTube or any of that kind of stuff. It seems like this is where they kind of exist. And then I'll also link directly to their, I don't know, it's maybe it's a minute of them singing Will You Go, Lassie Go. And that kind of gives you the two sides. You can click around on your phone until you feel like optimized as a tech knucklehead. Or you can just watch some people sing a very old song.
Yeah, that's great. I'm loving this. I think must be something in the water these days. Matt Pycroft, who does the Adventure podcast, he has a Substack as well, and he had a folk sort of British Isles folk song themed post last week as well.
Oh, nice.
And then between Sinners and that, and you know, remember I think it was during the pandemic, the kind of the interest in sea shanties.
Sea shanty, sure.
Yeah, and our good buddy Chris Soul plays I'm gonna get it wrong, some sort of Irish pipes. He started taking that up as a bit of a hobby, which is really cool. I love this sort of traditional music, and it's a nice counterpoint to your other final note. I think it's great to have kind of the yin and yang here. It's good
for sure. And I mean, I'm down the rabbit hole with Stan Rogers. We've talked about him a ton in the past. Yeah. You're really only making one leap from you know, very Eastern Canada and the Maritimes to Ireland.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a lot of connective tissue for the music that was made in Canada from the, you know, the traditional music of Ireland and the, you know, the Gaelic work and that sort of thing. So yeah, I'm not really sure what got me there. I've been listening to more Kingfisher. It might've been that. I've gone down the rabbit hole on a few more like modern Irish bands as well recently. All thanks to YouTube. And I think a lot of it probably is like one step removed from my still continued love of Triple J and Like a Virgin, the like cover series.
Oh, yeah.
Where then I'll be sitting on the Roku and it'll just keep feeding you more and more stuff and you find some interesting stuff that way. So I've been enjoying it. It's very light. If you want to dip in and dip out, you won't go down a rabbit hole just by listening to, you know, their lovely rendition of one of these songs. But it was nice to also, some of you will understand that like sometimes a door gets opened in your brain by a piece of music or a sound. And then when you can find its like mate, you can close that door. I'm not sure how better to describe it, but when I heard this song in Sinners, it felt like I had a home for it, or I'd heard a more traditional version of it or something like that. And this kind of got me there. I had another one recently with the theme from Ghost in the Shell.
Oh,
fantastic anime film. And I had heard this like Ukrainian choir sing a very similar like vocal work. I mean, I can put it in the show notes just if you just want to have some fun. I have it saved. I'll include it in the show notes. I don't remember what it's called or the rest of it, but you know, Ukrainian wild vocal work is also in there too. And it like, as soon as I heard one, I was like, oh, I wonder if that's where they got the inspiration for Ghost in the Shell. And like, you can listen to the both and you can feel some connective tissue there. I haven't been able to go deeper. I don't know enough about those two kind of like regionalities of music, Japanese music or Ukrainian music, and if there is any natural connection there, or if it's a one's, you know, if Ghost in the Shell is a love letter to this from just a person who appreciated it. I'm not sure, but yeah, so I'll include that in the show notes as well. It's very cool.
Well, we've rambled long enough. Let's log off here a bit and hope people enjoyed the chat with Cole, and thanks for taking the microphones along and doing that with him, and I look forward to hearing it.
Absolutely.
As always, I'm going to let you pronounce that person's name.
Yeah, I know.
That's as always, thanks so much for listening. If you want to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, or consider supporting the show directly, and maybe even grab a new TGN signed NATO, please visit thegraynato.com. Music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we'll leave you with this quote from Mokokoma Moko no Ana. The degree of our intellectual growth is inversely proportional to the number of people with whom we are still close friends.